Alrighty, welcome to the Surveillance Report 172 Q&A, where we are answering questions about F-Droid this week. We have some recommendations for other content, favorite tower in Balloon's Tower Defense, or favorite monkey, excuse me, email questions, proxies, data deletion services, single sign-on, all good questions this week. So real quick, before I jump in, I just want to remind patrons, because we're still doing the transition. Number one, if you're having a hard time telling between the regular episodes and the Q&A, the regular episodes have a number up in the top right corner of the thumbnail, so just look for that. If you are an audio listener, there is no thumbnail, so easy peasy. If you're an audio listener and it's just the Surveillance Report logo, then that's a Q&A. If there's a thumbnail, it's a regular episode, and for viewers, just look for the number in the top right corner. And then as a reminder to patrons, if you would like to ask a question on our Q&A, be sure to leave it on Q&A posts. So this post right here that you're listening to, go find it on Patreon, leave your question for the next Q&A. With that, we will start with Yaya, who says, I saw some posts a while back saying F-Droid has some security issues related to F-Droid signing developers' apps instead of developers signing them themselves, and maybe some other issues, but I can't remember. I think the posts were from a couple years ago, and F-Droid seems to have had some big upgrades since then. Is this something we still need to worry about, and can F-Droid's security rather than privacy be trusted as much as Google Play's? So Henry definitely has some thoughts here and probably knows more than I do, but I will speak to the things that I'm aware of. As usual, I think this depends on your threat model. I just want to caveat that. I think for the average person, these risks are seriously overblown. I think most of them were kind of nitpicky, in my opinion. Some of them, I think, were concerning. Like, they were running on the infrastructure backend. They were running some really outdated Debian stuff, which I think, I could be wrong, but I think as of this current recording, they've actually upgraded to the most recent version. So that should be fixed. They might have even switched to Ubuntu, but I could be wrong about that. The whole signing, it's not the developers themselves, if I understand correctly. It's like the developers are co-signing, and the idea is to prevent somebody from pushing malicious code, which, in answer to your actual question, I think that's a point in their favor, is from what I can tell, they seem to be manually reviewing like every ad, every update, which, you know, Google kind of automates that a little bit. So, you know, we see a lot of malware on the Play Store. And that's not to say the Play Store is just riddled with malware, but, you know, malware makes it through because a lot of their stuff is automated. I don't know F-Droid's full system, and I don't know how qualified the people doing the reviewing are, but they do seem to put a lot of manual checks in there. And again, things can still make it through, but I do think personally that, to me, seems to indicate a little bit more of a higher standard. There's also some concerns with the Target SDK, which basically has to do with, like, how much data about your device the apps are capable of seeing. I believe that's something that's still in progress. So I would like to see them fix this stuff for the record. I'm not trying to say like, oh, it's overblown. Don't just, it's fine as is. But I think they are doing a lot of solid work. And I think the current concerns, unless you have a high threat model, are a little bit exaggerated. That's my two cents.
Yeah, I don't have too much to add there. I think that if you appreciate the kind of manual checks that they're doing and the fact that they're going through all the apps and they're checking if things have ads in them, if things are open source, and all that stuff, and they're doing those labeling, that the labeling system that they have, like, then I think that's something, that's the reason you're using F-Droid. Another thing I'll add here, the only thing I'm going to add actually, is that if you're a developer and you have an issue with them essentially handling this, you can still host your own repo on F-Droid. So I believe Bromite, when it was a thing, and even things like NewPipe, you can actually add the repo manually, and that way you're not going through F-Droid, and you can still get things directly from the developer. So that's still an option if developers want to take that to the next level, and if you as a user, sometimes you have the option of getting it from F-Droid or from the developer, you can add the repo yourself if they give that as an option.
Or, you know, you can use Obtainium, which I've started digging into lately, and I really like it. You can still pull from F-Droid for things that you can't find directly, but, I mean, that does, again, depends on your threat model. If the F-Droid people are reviewing and co-signing every app, then it kind of reduces the risk of a malicious upload directly from GitHub with Obtainium. But at the same time, if you just want, like, the latest and greatest as fast as possible, because, not to go off topic, but I remember that with Bitwarden, when Bitwarden rolled out passkey support, it took, like, almost a week for it to roll out on F-Droid, and I was really annoyed waiting for that because I was eager to try out passkeys firsthand. So you know, that's an option if you're unhappy with F-Droid.
Mm-hmm. Next question is from Apricot, and they pretty much are saying that they like to read and listen to things about privacy and security, and they love the channel, so really glad that you like this. They like Surveillance Report. They really like Michael Basil. They've heard us talk about Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons, and they're also subscribed to Bleeping Computer. And besides all of this, pretty much, like, where do we get our information from? What do we recommend is essentially the question. And so I guess on my end, I really like to follow Slashdot just because it's not just digital rights focused. It also kind of broadens out into more tech stuff and even sometimes things outside of the tech world. So actually, I don't really get news outside of the tech world. And Slashdot kind of gives me just maybe a weekly highlight story of something happening outside the world, which is really nice. But I don't really engage much with news or content. And I think it's perfectly fine if people enjoy the content, people are engaging with this, and I think that's fantastic. But, like, all of my time and energy goes into, like, producing and being involved in this and working on my own stuff. And, like, I don't want to spend my free time engaging more with it, if that makes sense. So that's what I do on my end, Slashdot. And then there's the people we already talk about that you all probably already know about. And then that's it on my end.
Most of the resources I recommend are actually on the New Oil. If you go to thenewoil.org and then up the top banner, there's a links button. Actually, let me go there right now and look at it. Yeah, so you go to links and then, yep, right there. The very first section says resources and there's like books, there's documentaries, there's websites, there's podcasts and videos. As far as like other, not necessarily specifically privacy, I do like Bleeping Computer. They do really good work. 404 Media. Believe it or not, TechCrunch, I feel like, does pretty solid reporting. It's kind of split 50-50 because their target audience is like aspiring investors, I guess. So half of their content is like, this company just got $4 million in seed funding, and this is the new company making waves, and just crap that I personally don't care about. But then the other half is like, Europe is cracking down on Facebook's ad targeting ecosystem, and, you know, like, just stuff that's more relevant to privacy. So if you're willing to wade through some stuff, it's literally about 50-50 in my experience. So if you're willing to wade through some of that stuff, that's a good one. You mentioned Slashdot's a good one. I will try to remember to add, I used to have my RSS feed uploaded to the website. It was like thenewoil.org/news because so many people asked. I think we took it down because of the way that everything's automated right now. But I'll go ahead and like export my RSS feed and put it up in like Proton Drive, and we'll put a link in the description. So if you want, you can just import that. But those are who I follow. I'm just here for the privacy and security news with those. That's not who I follow for news, for the record. Our next question is from our classic Mr. Camel, who asks, which monkey is your favorite in Balloon's Tower Defense 6? And I'm mad you said 6, because my favorite was the Balloon Chipper, but they got rid of him in 6. Probably because he was... Dude, he was so OP. That's probably why they got rid of him, which is fair, but it still frustrates me.
Yeah, I don't remember using it much when I used the 5th one.
Oh my god. Dude, I abused the Balloon Chipper. Because when you upgraded it all the way, it could literally suck in Moabs. So, like, it was literally just a chain of, like, sucking in Moabs constantly. It was way overpowered.
Yeah, well, you haven't checked out 6 then, because if you get the highest upgrade for the Monkey Buccaneer, there's like a 5th upgrade path. I forgot what it's called. But that one sucks in the bads. And it sucks in the Moabs, and it sucks in everything, actually, including the big purple ones. But that's like, you have to use the power-up to suck that in.
Oh, yeah. See, I never pay attention to the power-ups.
I didn't either, but you have to.
I have my Buccaneer all the way decked out, I think.
Pretty much in Balloon's Tower Defense 6, there's like the 4. There's the 3 yeah. rows of 4, but then you can unlock a 5th one, and you have to... Essentially, okay, cool.
I know.
I didn't play
I'm
that.
Just saying, I have them all unlocked, I've just never used that one.
Oh, got it. I like the Druid and the Monkey Buccaneer.
The Druid's pretty dope. I do like the Buccaneer a lot, but if I had to pick a favorite go-to, it's definitely the Helicopter.
I like the Helicopter too. Helicopter's fun.
I use the crap out of the Helicopter.
Yeah. I also, I mean, like, I don't know, the underrated is the Banks. Like, you can't really get anywhere in a game without the Banks, I feel.
The hard thing about the Banks is, like, I mean, just like with anything in real life, it's like the upfront investment, because you have to spend so much money to get them to where they need to be. But yeah, like once the money starts coming in, it's like, again, it's just like real life. It's like it breaks the game. It's like, I have so much money, I can just do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Banks are great. You got to be real strategic with them because they require so much upfront investment.
Question from David, and this is a big question here. Pretty much it's going to go into email here, and it's the general question is, how do you balance convenience against privacy and security when checking email? On one hand, using a client like Thunderbird or Microsoft Office Outlook is easier than using a browser, especially to go through multiple accounts. While this can be helped a bit by automatic forwarding, there are still valid security privacy requirements to keep at least some accounts completely separate in regards to aliasing and things like that. Second, it's good to be able to receive email alerts promptly for important accounts. Third, it is very convenient to be able to simultaneously search all of your emails for all messages that contain a specific string. And then it seems like standalone email client applications are more vulnerable to emails with malicious payloads than browsers are. In addition, some of the secure email providers like Proton and Tuta probably either aren't compatible with IMAP, SMTP, or POP, or using those protocols would nullify the extra security. How do you approach reconciling these competing priorities in your use of email? And on my end, I'm going to always start by saying this is extremely personal preference, and I know people who will refuse to use email in their browser. But personally for me, I don't use any of those features. My email use case is very straightforward and probably similar to what most other people's email use case is, which is just they have one or two or three email inboxes max, and probably only one that they need to check on a daily basis. And so for me, I do it all on the web, even though Proton just released their new desktop client, and I have access to it because I'm a paid subscriber, I'm not using it. I'm still going to be using it in the web just because I have that additional sandboxing from my web browser. I can still get notified from my web browser as well. So the notification thing you can still do through your web browser if your email client in the web supports it. And I just don't need any of those features. But I totally understand why someone would want to use a desktop client like something like Thunderbird, Microsoft Office Outlook, or something like that. So if you need the features, you probably know. And as long as you can justify it and you're aware of the, I guess, additional security concerns behind just instantly receiving emails inside those clients, then go for it. But I personally just stay on the web.
So I'm actually kind of the opposite. I use Thunderbird a lot, mostly because of cubes in my setup and everything. I'm not really worried about it, to be honest. I feel like most malware that would come through email would come in the form of like phishing or like a malicious download. And when that happens, I know I've mentioned in the past that, like, you know, if somebody sends us a link, I will open a VM and open it in that. And same thing with attachments. Some of you guys have sent attachments before. And again, I open that in a VM and I open it there and I look at it there. So for me personally, I'm not super worried about that. And even if you can't run cubes, you know, there's things like, what's it called? Like VirtualBox, VMware. So you can still do that. But I'm not really worried about like a zero click, like, oh, it just arrives in my inbox and now I'm compromised. Like, if I get targeted with something like that, I'm probably screwed to begin with. We're probably talking about a highly resourced adversary who's specifically targeting me, and that's just outside my threat model.
Where I might fight back a little bit, though, is, you know, for an average consumer, they're not going to be using VirtualBox, VMware, cubes, and they might just... I feel like it's easier to be infected if you use something like a desktop client versus the web, especially since now web browsers have a lot of built-in scanning tools that essentially can scan links and things for you, and even check your downloads before you download them.
And that's fair, and it's a really good point, but also, like you said, the average user doesn't have six email inboxes, you know, or how many do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4... Yeah, about six.
Yeah, so isn't that more reason for them to be on the web?
But I want them all separated because one is for like important stuff, one is for the new oil, one
is
for...
Yeah, I'm saying for an average person, not you.
Oh, for an average person, yeah. I'm just saying, like, I guess what I'm saying is I don't really think there's much of a security issue using a client if you want to, because if you know how to use a client, you're probably like already aware of these things and you're probably already doing that. So... Sorry, yeah, that's where I was going with that. I think web is perfectly good, but also I think if you're smart enough to use a client, like, not to sound rude, but like smart enough to use a client, you're probably already aware of that stuff too. I think it's good you're asking these questions, but I don't want to like sound mean, but this sounds like one of those things where I'm not sure if you really have a clearly defined threat model in mind when you're asking these questions. What is your concern specifically? Is it malware? Is it making a mistake and clicking on the malware? Because to be fair, that can happen to all of us. Like, I'm not trying to say I'm too good for that or anything, but Our next question comes from Rasta, who says, what are your thoughts on ISP proxies? They seem to be both good and bad from what I can tell. Good because they can be used to offer more anonymity. I'm going to put an asterisk there. But it also defeats part of the purpose of using a VPN or DNS filter. And then they linked an article from Hackread, which I took a look at about ISP proxies. According to that article, the advantage is that they're less likely to be blocked because they show up as residential IP addresses. I'll be honest, I'm still trying to understand the value of a proxy at all. I don't understand why you wouldn't just go with a VPN. Very few of the services I use block VPNs, except for like Reddit, but screw them. I don't know. I don't see the point of a proxy over a VPN in general. Because even some of the VPNs that we recommend, like Windscribe and Proton, offer free plans. And you also mentioned a DNS filter, so I just don't see the point in general. I don't have thoughts on ISP proxies specifically because I don't see the point of proxies at all. I don't know if you know more than
I don't. This is the first time I hear about ISP proxies.
The article doesn't really explain. Is it? I don't know if it's like an offering from your ISP, in which case, again, what's the point? Because like your ISP is still kind of like, that's why I use a VPN, is because I don't trust my ISP. I don't use it to stop the website from tracking me or anything. That's what all the other things I use are for, like hardened browsers. And I mean, the ISP changes the IP address, but other than that, like, you know, content blockers, DNS filtering, like that's what I use that for. The VPN is strictly so that my ISP can't spy on me. That is my main use for an ISP personally. So the idea of like an ISP is like, oh, but it still offers, like, if it's from your ISP, then for me personally, it's kind of like I'm not really gaining much here that I can't already replicate with other things. But yeah, I don't know. If you want to leave more information, I'm totally willing to learn more. But for me, I just don't see the point of a proxy at all.
Next question is from 10. And the question is, how do I choose between Incogni, Delete Me, and other services? So this is a great question because it's one that even I struggle with, because we have, like, behind the scenes, most of us use one of these services. Like, some of the people I talk to behind the scenes use them, and we all choose different ones, and we all just kind of have random reasons for choosing them. You know, for the most part, we all pick their trustworthy services. They're not run by data broker people, like some services we just covered in surveillance support in the last couple weeks. but it's kind of confusing. It's hard as an end user to know, because some of them say they, you know, remove information from more services than another one, but there's no way. Some of them say they'll remove it from 10,000 and what the other one says 300, so you go the one that does 10,000 better, right? But then you look into how they get to that number and it's questionable. So it just seems like a very weird industry. And on my end, again, I kind of have a nice luxury/privilege that I get to talk to people behind the services. And I've already done a couple interviews now with the CEO of Delete Me. And not only do we talk in the interview, but I can talk to him before and after the interview, and he'll ask a lot more questions. And so that's what I needed to sign up for Delete Me personally. But I haven't seen any reason not to go with Incogni. And actually, I know a couple people who do use it. So I'd say just go with one of the trusted ones that people commonly share and do your due research. And I still have not found like a good way to separate what's a good and bad one, to be honest. I don't know if you have had any more luck.
I agree 100%. I don't really trust Incogni.
Oh, Incogni is the one run by Nord/Surfshark. I forgot about that.
Oh, there we go. That's why I don't trust them. Never mind.
Yeah, I guess I kind of take back a little bit what I said. I personally wouldn't go with them just based on that relationship. There's other ones that are more trustworthy that I've seen that people are using.
Easy opt-outs and My Data Removal are the other two I list on my website. I agree with you 100%. I would really love to have an objective...
Yeah, it's hard.
...criteria of some kind, but I haven't been able to come up with one. And I'm very open to one. Like, by all means, if anybody's like, ooh, this would make a great criteria, please open like a GitHub issue or a GitLab issue. Please let me know. But yeah, mostly the three that I listed Delete Me because of their reputation. And the other two is just like you said, like I've been able to talk to the people behind them. They have been incredibly transparent with me. And I feel very reassured that like, okay, these guys are at very least trying. They're legit. And they're not just double dipping or whatever. For about a week or two there, we did list the Mozilla one just because they're Mozilla. And then as soon as those allegations started coming out, it was like, you're gone. And I will definitely be taking my time if I relist them again whenever they unscrew that situation. I know a while back I did do a couple videos, and if you go look them up, please be patient because my production quality was much worse back then. But I did do a couple videos about data brokers and data removal services, and I cited a Google document, like a spreadsheet, that was made by the guys from Easy Opt-Outs. And I said that in the video. I'm like, these, you know, there's a conflict of interest here, but as far as I can tell, it is legit. Oh, I remember one of the things that you didn't mention that I want to add is different services remove different things. So, you know, one service might cover 214 websites, but they only remove like your name and your email address. Whereas this other service might cover 150, but they'll get your phone number as well or something like that, you know? So they had a whole spreadsheet where they were like the different services, where they were based out of, what they removed, how many websites they went through. It was like, it was a really good spreadsheet. Just again, you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt because there's a conflict of interest there. But as far as I could tell, it was reliable. I'm with you. Like the ones I've recommended are either Delete Me because of their reputation or the two that I've been able to directly talk to the people behind them and they seem trustworthy. But not everyone has that luxury. And our last question comes from Ken. How secure and private is sign-in with Google services? From my understanding, it is a quick method, but it does lend some basic data to Google. The information doesn't appear very invasive based on the average person's threat model. That said, I would be concerned that it creates a more pervasive single point of failure if, say, your Google is ever hacked. Essentially, I want to know your guys' thoughts from a privacy perspective, from someone who has a fairly average threat model but isn't too concerned with basic information. So I don't want to overload this show description with a bunch of links, but I'm going to link almost a year ago. I was able to go to EFF Austin. Is like, they're not the actual EFF, but they are like a local activist group. I was able to attend one of their meetups and they had somebody speaking about OAuth, which is the protocol that single sign-in uses, you know, so sign in with Google, sign in with Apple, all that kind of stuff. It's actually incredibly more private and secure than I understood. This organization that they filmed at, this venue, seems to basically just stick a webcam in the ceiling and call it a day. So the audio is not great. You might have to turn it up a lot. But I found it incredibly insightful and it really taught me a lot. He goes into incredible detail of every step of the process, what's shared, what isn't shared, etc. So single sign-on, after sitting through that talk, single sign-on doesn't really concern me from a privacy or security perspective, other than like you said, if something's compromised, they could sign in with that account. What concerns me more, and I'm actually living through this situation, is apparently back in the day, I made an Imgur account with Facebook single sign-on, and I haven't had a Facebook account in probably about 8 years now, maybe more. So I just can never get rid of my Imgur account because I can't sign in to delete it, and how am I going to convince them that it's me, and just all, yeah. So that's more what I'm concerned about these days is like, what happens if you decide I'm ready to move on from this account and you're just signed in forever because you can't like delete it. Short version, I'm not too worried about it, but you can watch that video and make up your own mind.
Yeah. And I guess it's not live yet, so I won't have a link, but if you're subscribed on the TechLore side of things, I recently interviewed John Osbay from Crypti. And they have a sign in with Google thing that I asked him about, and he went into fine detail into how it works. I'm going to try to condense it super briefly here. And pretty much what it does is it essentially the website sends a ping. It just sends a ping saying, hey, is this user logged into a Google account in the browser? And Google simply, if you're logged in, it's like yes, and then it pretty much just logs in through that account. And if it's no, then it's just no. There's no like direct PII shared whatsoever outside of just asking if there's a user logged in. And something that people don't talk about, John was talking about how it's all open source, so you can actually look at the code yourself to see what sign in with Google does. All I'll add here is I actually, in general, I think that if a service is properly secured, you trust the service, and you enjoy the service, the service offers you 2FA, you have all those nice options, I like to just go through the service because I have a password manager, I have good practices, and that way you don't have to go through an SSO provider. Where sign-in with Google can be really nice is when you have to register for a service that you just don't trust what they're doing behind the scenes. Then it's really nice to have sign-in with Google because then you can at least rely on Google's infrastructure instead. You don't have to directly give up your password to some random sketch website. And also, if the site doesn't have something like 2FA, you can actually gain access to something like 2FA if you're signing in through Google indirectly. and even things like YubiKeys, because you can use YubiKey with a Google account, but a lot of services online don't support YubiKeys. So it's kind of a workaround solution to sometimes gain additional security on some of your accounts, but it's all relative for what the site is and what security you have in your Google account as well. In general, I say if you have a good password manager, you have good 2FA, you have good practices, you can go ahead and avoid it if you're not someone who's involved with Google, especially a lot of our audience who wants to get away from Google, definitely try to avoid it. But there are sometimes good security perks, I think, to using it. And there's no privacy issue in my head whatsoever, actually, for anybody. If you use Google or don't use Google, the button on the site's not doing anything that's invading your privacy.
All right, those were all our questions this week. So thank you to all our awesome patrons who keep us going. Thank you for your support. If you would like to join them and ask us a question, you can do so for $5 a month at our Patreon, which is linked in the show notes. And again, for those who are patrons at $5 a month or more, if you want to ask a question for next week, go ahead and leave it in the comments of this episode, and we will go ahead and see that, and it'll come out shortly after the podcast, the next podcast, 173. So thank you guys so much, and we will see you in the next one.